Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Beyond the Pearls podcast, based on the Morning Report series from Elsevier. This podcast has been adapted for audio in collaboration with series editor Dr. Raj Dasgupta, as well as the volume editor for each book. Each episode features an in-depth case dissection format and aims to deliver practical, concise, and easy-to-digest information. And now, here's today's episode.
So, let's just go to, before we go to my 10 questions, how do you diagnose osteoporosis?
So there's two different ways to diagnose someone with osteoporosis, and then a third way or a third avenue by which someone might qualify for osteoporotic treatment. And so, you know, you could say maybe that is a diagnosis of osteoporosis, or you're just saying you're treating those people with the medication. So the first way, like I said earlier, is a clinical diagnosis of osteoporosis, and that would be in anybody who has suffered an osteoporotic fracture already. So someone who has had a fragility fracture in the past, someone who comes in with a hip fracture or a spine fracture, those are probably the two most common areas, but you could also see osteoporotic or fragility fractures in the wrist, the distal forearm, the proximal humerus near the shoulder, and the ribs. Those would be kind of the most common areas. If someone has already had a fragility fracture in that area, it actually does not matter what their bone density is. That person has a clinical diagnosis of osteoporosis, and that person most likely would benefit from medication going forward to try and reduce their risk.
God, you get me so fired up all the time. So is that in real medicine, clinical medicine, how many endocrinologists, primary care, rheumatologists will accept a clinical diagnosis in the sense that will that cover medications based on the clinical diagnosis, or do you really have to go on and get that DEXA, which you're going to be talking about soon?
From a practical standpoint, most of those patients still should get a DEXA, not only because, as you alluded to, there might be insurance requirements where to get certain medications, the insurance company might say, I understand your diagnosis of clinical osteoporosis, but we are still going to require a bone density test to see where the bone density is. But then also from a practical standpoint and a management standpoint going forward, we use the bone density, you know, for better or for worse, we use the bone density as our marker of treatment therapy for a lot of patients. We use changes in bone density. So
is that number two? Is that the second way to do
it? Correct. Okay. But yes, we would use changes in bone density to determine, you know, is a treatment being effective or not to some extent. So so you'd want to get a baseline in those patients. Even if you've decided I'm going to treat this patient no matter what the bone density shows, you're still probably going to get that bone density test so that you have your baseline.
And bone density, you know, just is basically looking at the bone in three main areas, right? There's hip, there's wrist, and where's the other one?
The lumbar spine.
Lumbar spine. Those are the three areas that we really focus on. Is that correct?
And those are the three areas that we focus on. One, because yes, they are common areas to see osteoporotic fractures, but more importantly, just those are the areas that have been validated as correlating with fracture risk, right?
Okay.
That there is this relationship that the lower your bone density in those three areas, generally speaking, the higher your risk of fracture.
And that would be the air quote gold standard is the DEXA.
A DEXA using a two-dimensional dual X-ray absorptiometry DEXA scan is the standard. Is it going to be the standard forever? Maybe not. There might be something that will replace it because there certainly are limitations that come with it. But certainly in research studies and in clinical practice, DEXA is sort of what we're using.
Now, you alluded to a third way, and I don't even know what third way is, so I got to hear it from the horse's mouth. What is the third way to diagnose?
The second way, just to close up the gap there, is, if you get the DEXA and you fall below this arbitrary threshold of your bone density in one of the areas that's measured, then we would assume that if your bone density is low enough, your risk of fracture is high enough, that therefore you would benefit from medication. Mm-hmm. So the third way is basically if you say, well, I got the patient's never had an osteoporotic fracture yet, and I want to prevent them from ever having a fracture if their risk is high enough. Mm-hmm. Their bone density hasn't met this threshold to classify them as high risk for fracture based purely on their bone density. That's number two. Number three would be, what if there are other factors at play?
Okay.
Sort of the things you were alluding to. So family history, ethnicity, one factor I alluded to earlier, which is age. What if you take other factors into consideration and that either with or without bone density, what if you then calculated a risk of fracture? And if you determine that their risk of fracture is above a certain threshold, then you might say, well, even though their bone density doesn't reach the threshold, when I take into consideration these other factors, it increases my suspicion or my estimated risk for them to have a fracture in the future. And so I do think this patient would benefit from pharmacotherapy, from drug therapy.
Okay, I see where this is going. So I was assuming that you were talking about a blood test or urine test or something like that. You're referring to a calculated score, and I believe you're talking about the FRAX score, right?
So yeah, more generally, I'm referring to any risk assessment model.
Okay.
There's multiple different risk assessment models that have been constructed and calculated out there for this purpose.
Yeah.
In the United States, at least, and in many countries around the world, the risk assessment model that is used most frequently is, as you said, the FRAX tool.
Yeah.
Yes.
And now, you know what? I just made this up. I mean, my wife, who's a rheumatologist, one time got a consult. Someone ordered some blood work about osteoporosis, and we both kind of shook our heads a little bit. Mm-hmm. Is there any blood work that people commonly order for osteoporosis out there, or is that something that's kind of, maybe it's still in the more research phase? You know what I mean? Anything like that?
So I think from an assessment of osteoporosis standpoint.
Yeah.
So there's definitely some lab testing that should be ordered in every patient that you are diagnosing with osteoporosis or that you are saying, oh, this person is high risk for fracture, either because they've already had a fracture or because their bone density is low or because using a risk assessment model, their risk of fracture is high. You should do some blood testing to look for reversible causes, things that you could intervene, and these are secondary causes of either bone loss and or increased risk of fracture that you could fix, that you could do something.
So like
right?
a thyroid and parathyroid. But what about a bone? Is there a bone marker of osteoporosis out there?
So you're referring to markers of bone turnover.
Yeah, does anyone order those?
Bone turnover markers, BTMs.
BTMs.
Yeah,
sounds like I get ordered from a deli or something.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, delicious. So, yes, there are people who order them, and they're.
Do you order them
in some patients?
Really?
Yes.
What are some? I'm just now. I know I'm going to ask you. What
sure,
are
sure.
Do you do them in the pre-diagnosis phase or during the treatment phase?
I think probably the best proposed use of these bone turnover markers is to help with monitoring of treatment or monitoring of efficacy of certain types of treatments.
Interesting.
So there's two different sort of types of bone turnover markers. There's markers of bone formation. So these would be
the builders,
the construction crew, the osteoblasts. So we would say that the higher these levels, the more action of the osteoblasts we assume there are. Mm-hmm. And then we have markers of bone resorption. So these would be the lower they are, the more that the resorption is being inhibited.
Okay.
And so, you know, I think one way that these have been proposed as being used, and one way that a lot of people do use them, and I use them from time to time, is if you're putting a patient on a therapy that you want the therapy to decrease bone resorption, right? To calm down the demolition crew.
Okay.
So you would measure their level before you start the treatment, and then you'd measure the level sometime after you start treatment. And you'd want to see, is this medication getting into the patient's body effectively? Because with some of these medications that treat osteoporosis, absorption from the gastrointestinal tract is a big problem. And so you want to see, is the medication actually getting into the patient's body and doing what we want it to do?
Is this going to be used in junction combined with that DEXA? Or
absolutely,
it is combined with the DEXA.
Currently, you know, all guidelines and most you know, kind of recommendations out there would be that the DEXA is something you're going to get in everybody. And again, it's an imperfect tool, but I think it's probably the best that we have for right now. The bone turnover markers would be something you might do in addition to the bone density
test. Wow, dude, I hope everyone out there became a lot smarter. That was the strongest beginning for osteoporosis. So now, this is the patient who comes to see you, if they're lucky enough. You're quite busy, you know what I mean? So here are some questions I want them to ask you or any of your doctors or healthcare providers that have that know you have osteoporosis. So I think this is a very good one for the audience. Are there ways to keep my osteoporosis from getting worse?
Absolutely. So patients ask me that all the time, and it's part of what I counsel patients on all the time. So the first things to think about would be what are the things that anyone can do and doesn't involve any medication.
No medication. Right? For this time, yeah.
So usually what I tell patients is we want to make sure, number one, that they're getting enough calcium. Okay. Calcium is sort of the raw material, the raw building block that our bones use for regular maintenance. What I usually tell patients is to aim for approximately 1,200 milligrams or 1,200 milligrams of elemental calcium in total per day. So when I say in total, I'm talking about calcium you get from foods you eat, calcium you get from beverages you drink, and calcium you get from supplements that you take.
Okay.
So that does not mean you have to take 1,200 milligrams of calcium supplement. It means that all of it added together should add up to about 1,200 milligrams. We don't want people coming in too far below this, but we also don't need or want people to go significantly above that either. There, in the past, people have tried to say, well, if I just shove enough calcium into this person, then maybe it's going to help their bones. And we know that there can be detriment that comes along with taking too much calcium
as
well.
So let me ask you this. I'm just making this up as I go along.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, when you give supplemental calcium, and many people are on supplemental calcium.
Sure.
I don't usually go around ordering a follow-up basic metabolic panel to see what their calcium is. Do you do that? Because it's not easy to overdose on calcium unless you're just kind of a moron, right?
Correct. Well, at least unless you're given bad guidance, I guess. But or you're just trying to turn into a turn into a piece of chalk or something.
Yeah, exactly.
But no, blood calcium levels don't correlate very well with calcium intake unless people are on one extreme end of the spectrum or the other.
Okay.
Our body is very, very good at maintaining our calcium levels in the normal range most of the time, regardless of how much calcium we're getting. Right. But if someone has a slight or a more moderate deficiency of calcium in their blood, in their body, their intake, then the assumption is that basically their body is stealing or leaching calcium from the bones to prop up the calcium in the blood. So calcium levels in the blood are not a good indicator of calcium intake.
And you can also look at it this way. If you're affecting the calcium levels in the blood, then you're screwed.
Sure.
Because you already are beyond the range of autoregulation. So by that time, you're either really deficient or have too much in you.
Right.
I love the seeds. That was a great question.
It was a great question.
Yeah, I don't know how that came from, you know. But what about, you know, I'm going to ask you, vitamin D.
Vitamin D. So I also recommend making sure patients get an adequate amount of vitamin D. Now, with vitamin D, it's a little trickier in terms of the right amount. What I usually advise my patients is I think we should get a vitamin D level checked. If your vitamin D level is at goal, which different people use different goals, I use a vitamin D level or a vitamin D goal of 30 to 50. If my patient is already at goal between 30 to 50, then I say, whatever you're doing now, whether that's no supplementation or a little bit of supplementation, if whatever amount you're taking now is fine, stick with it. Mm-hmm. If their level is too low, I tell them, you either need to start a vitamin D supplement if you're not taking one, or you need to increase your dose if you're already taking one. If their level is over 50, if it's only a little bit over 50, I might just kind of leave them on it. Mm-hmm. If they're getting up into the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, that is definitely a level that I think we don't really see any increased benefit. And there might be a slight increased risk, specifically of kidney stones. Mm-hmm. And so I'll usually advise my patients to actually ratchet down their vitamin D supplementation a little bit.
So let me ask you, you know, for the dosing, mm-hmm. you know, I'll tell you what I take. Everyone, I take vitamin D. My vitamin D level was low.
Okay.
You
know, yep.
Dr. Raj, if you haven't met me, I'm a little brown in color. So I'm not a big fan of the sun. You know? So yeah. maybe that's the reason.
Sure.
But I take 2,000 units mm-hmm. daily, you know. So if you're a woman or this or that, do you pull out a calculator to get the exact dosing, or you just do 2,000 across the board?
I usually, if somebody is not taking a supplement to start with, mm-hmm. and I think 2,000 units is a good starting point, because I've seen patients who are taking less than that, who are not reaching their goals, who are still too low, and mm-hmm. I've had to increase them. I haven't seen too many people who have been on 2,000 units a day and who need to be on higher doses than that, with the exception of patients who have known malabsorption issues, so intestinal issues. They don't absorb, you know, maybe several different nutrients or minerals, mm-hmm. Vitamins, things like that. They might need significantly higher doses. But for your sort of standard patient who doesn't seem to have a major malabsorption issue or mm-hmm. something like that, I haven't seen too many patients who need more than 2,000 units a day.
That's good. No. Yeah. And I love this question right here I'm coming up with. You know, lately, have you been finding a lot of patients ask you about these supposed benefits of vitamin D? Because vitamin D is hot, right? And especially during the COVID time. You know, yeah. I'm your favorite pulmonary critical care doctor.
Of course, yeah.
There was a time where, hey, if you don't want COVID, you better get your vitamin D going.
Right.
Or, hey, if you don't want to have Alzheimer's, you need vitamin D.
You don't want
a heart attack.
Yeah.
I mean, I know you're a nice guy. You just kind of nod your head like, yeah, you're right, buddy. Or what do you think about all this hoopla about vitamin D?
I think that, you know, we probably are giving vitamin D in some respects maybe a little more credit than it deserves. But at the same time, I don't think there's a lot of harm to come from it as long as people aren't taking really super high, excessively high doses. You know, as far as the COVID stuff and the the sort of immunologic benefits, yep. I would probably defer to, you know, someone with more knowledge in that field. But again, I can't really think of a reason why it would be a bad thing. There was, you know, a recent large study in an older population where they just sort of, without measuring baseline vitamin D levels,
yeah.
they put a large group of people on either 2,000 units of vitamin D or placebo, and followed them mainly for skeletal outcomes, you know, osteoporosis
yeah.
and fractures. But we're looking at a wide variety of different outcomes, and they basically saw no difference.
So, I can imagine.
So, you know, I think vitamin D is... We might give it more credit than it deserves. I still think, you know, do I tell my patients that, especially my patients with osteoporosis, that I want them to get enough of it? Absolutely. But do I think it is the cure of all maladies? You know, probably not.
No.
Thank you for listening to the Beyond the Pearls podcast from Inside the Boards. This podcast is executive produced by Christopher Brightigan and Dr. Patrick Beeman. This podcast is intended for educational purposes only and is not medical advice. Ars longa, vita brevis.